second husband. In May of 1802, Martha Washington died, transferring the majority of her estate to her heirs. Mrs. Washington's wishes included the sale of the majority of her property, the proceeds of which would be divided among her grandchildren. None of the dower slaves at Mount Vernon were offered their freedom. Instead, they were relocated to different farms and endured the dismantling of their fragile families. The transfer of the dower slaves to her grandchildren was not simply done out of obligation or a legal requirement, but because of the First Lady's commitment to the institution of slavery. Unlike her husband, Martha Washington left no suggestion that she was ambivalent about slavery. At the end of her life, Martha Washington held only one slave who was not a part of the dower inheritance, a man named Elish. She could have emancipated Elish upon her death, but she chose not to. Instead, Elish was willed to her grandson, George Washington Park Custis. The deaths of George and Martha Washington meant very little to the day-to-day actions of Ona Staines and her growing family. She continued to navigate her way through the joys of parenthood, marriage, and life outside the confines of slavery. By the turn of the 19th century, Ona Staines and her husband lived with their children in their own home. The fugitive and her husband became members of Portsmouth's free black community, although her name and complete address were never recorded. While no deed or probate record exists under the name of Jack Staines, it is quite possible that the young family rented their home from an employer. Perhaps her employers rented her a small home on the fringes of their property, as was the custom with many free blacks across the North. They found lodging and employment wherever and however they could. When asked about her life in 1847, Mrs. Staines told a reporter from the Liberator that she had three children. Inaccurate record-keeping of the early 19th century leaves sketchy documentation about the lives of the Staines' children, but existing records suggest that 4 years after the birth of Eliza Staines, the family welcomed little Nancy to their growing household, perhaps named after the ship that brought the fugitive to New Hampshire. The Staines' third child left behind a more mysterious trail of documentation. No death certificate or record of birth exists for the Staines' third child, her only son. It is possible that the third child of the Staines family was William Staines. As an adult, William Staines registered for a Seaman's Protection Certificate in the government office in New York and Portland, Maine. Beginning in 1796, the Congress began to issue these certificates in order to protect American seamen from impressment on British ships. This certificate provided proof of American citizenship and offered physical descriptions of the seamen. In December of 1819, William Staines was 19 years old and was prepared to sail out of New York City. The seaman was described by governmental authorities as 5'9" and 3/4" in height, with a light complexion. Physical characteristics such as racial complexions included light, dark, brown, yellow, and mulatto, though this, as well as other descriptive characteristics, were left to the discretion of governmental authorities. In March of 1823, another description of a William Staines appeared among the Seaman's Protection Certificates in Portland, Maine, where officials recorded him as 5'10" in height, with a dark, dark complexion. Both certificates in New York and Maine list the sailor's birthplace as Portsmouth, New Hampshire, with a birth date around 1800. The only Portsmouth family with the surname of Staines belonged to Ona and her husband Jack, connecting William to the family, or at least to the patriarch. So it's more than likely that this young William was hers, and that he was following in the shoes of his father and many other black men from northeastern seaport towns, taking to the open seas for a sustainable form of employment. And if William Staines knew the story of his mother's escape, then he also understood that he was technically an enslaved person, a fugitive who belonged to the Park Custis estate. It is understandable that William Staines would have purposely avoided being counted during the course of his lifetime, and that he chose the profession of seafaring, which frequently took him to faraway places. Like their free counterparts, the family worked hard to scratch out a living, with Jack Staines constantly at sea, and Ona Staines most likely picking up domestic work while she cared for their small children. Their family was fragile, as free blacks across the new nation found themselves only a few steps removed from slavery and poverty. Illness or the death of a loved one could completely change the life circumstances of a family teetering on the brink of survival. For women, the situation became even bleaker in the wake of the loss of a husband or son. And indeed, Ona Staines confronted this reality when Jack passed away. Seafaring men risked their lives every time they left the docks, and illness was often the cause for many deaths on the open seas. Although Ona Staines did not leave personal testimony about the death of her husband, we know that he was no longer a part of the Staines family after 1803. The circumstances of Jack Staines's death, was it protracted illness or sudden? Was it while he was at sea or in his own home? Remains a mystery to this day. But his death notice appeared in the New Hampshire Gazette on May 3, 1803. The specifics are lost, but the endurance of his fugitive wife was not. After only 6 years of marriage, Ona Staines found herself alone with young children, with no one but herself to rely upon financially. Once again, she was reliant upon her network of friends to find a way to survive. The Staines family lived close to neighbor John Bartlett, who offered the young widow a maidservant position. This form of employment would call for Ona Staines to live with the elderly Anne and John Bartlett in order to earn wages to support her young family. It is unclear, but improbable, that Staines was allowed to bring her children to board with her. In most cases, women were forced to leave their children in the care of family members or friends for long periods of time. For Staines, this was too much to ask, and eventually she turned to her friends, the Jack family, to save her. The Jacks, as they were called by their neighbors and friends, was a free black household that had come to the rescue of the fugitive on at least one other occasion. In 1799, when Washington's nephew Bassett came to Portsmouth looking to reclaim Mrs. Staines and to take her back to Virginia, the fugitive turned to this family for help. The Jacks lived outside the city limits of Portsmouth in a small cottage in Greenland where they harbored Mrs. Staines and her toddler Eliza. After Jack Staines died, she found herself calling upon them again for assistance. But this time, it was at a juncture when the Jack family needed help themselves. The matriarch of the family, Phyllis Jack, had managed to turn her bondage into an opportunity. For unknown reasons, Jack's master, Deacon James Brackett, decided to let go of his human property sometime during the 1760s. With no raging abolitionist movement to propel him, we can only guess his reasons for emancipating a young slave woman before the Revolution. The only thing more startling than her freedom was the gift of land that accompanied it. Brackett gave his former slave a parcel of land and a small home that was surrounded by swampy wetlands. It wasn't uncommon for slave owners to move bondwomen, especially those with whom they had an ongoing sexual relationship, out of their homes and into private dwellings. Slave owners built small cottages buried deep in the woods where they could keep their prized possessions out of view from jealous wives, all with the hope of easing marital tensions. Just how Phyllis Jack came into her freedom, we don't know. But her status as a free, landowning black woman is notable. Phyllis Jack's land lay close to the border between Greenland and Streatham, a location at the center of a property line battle between the neighboring towns. Existing town records do not cite Phyllis Jack as the formal owner of the property. But other accounts and eyewitness reports place the former slave and her family on this parcel of land. Residents of Greenland often referred to the stream that ran through the property as Phyllis's Brook, while less enlightened neighbors simply called it Nigger's Brook. The patriarch of the Jack family was enslaved for a much longer stint than was his wife, but he earned his freedom by his service in the Revolutionary War. Like many enslaved people, Jack was called many names: Jack Warner, after his slave owner, John Jack, Black Jack, and Jacks. His daughters would eventually use the surname Jack on formal records and accounts. When Ona Staines turned to the Jack family again for help, they were themselves in dire straits. Matriarch Phyllis Jack died in October of 1804, only a year after the death of Jack Staines, and poverty had already fastened its grip on the family. Although the former slave had found freedom and amassed property, her family had slipped into the ranks of the desperately poor. So impoverished, her family couldn't even pay for an honorable funeral for Phyllis Jack. This was the case for many free black families across the Northeast, who simply could not afford the cost of a coffin, or to hire professional gravediggers. Mutual aid organizations in cities such as Philadelphia and New York provided assistance to black families for this kind of need. However, in Greenland, New Hampshire, no such organization existed. Private citizens stepped in to cover the cost of Phyllis Jack's funeral and to recognize her passing with the ringing of the town's bell. Ona Staines and her children eventually moved into the Jack home, fusing two desperate and grieving families into one. Close to 30 years old now, Staines was definitely capable of earning a decent wage, provided she had help raising her own small children. Living at the Jack home was the patriarch and his two daughters, Nancy and Phyllis Jr. Like Ona Staines, the women were in their 30s. Similar to other struggling black families, they pooled their meager resources to stay afloat. But over the next 10 years, it became nearly impossible for Ona Staines to support her children. In August of 1816, things were so bad for the Staines family that the unthinkable had to be confronted. Ona Staines would place her teenage daughters into indentured servitude. Her two northern-born daughters were bound out for a fee. Eliza and Nancy Staines went to work for Nathan Johnson, who lived about a mile away. In return for food and shelter, the sisters worked the fields and served the six members of the Johnson family. Nathan Johnson received $35 from the town coffers for agreeing to provide food and shelter to the impoverished teenagers. Johnson was doing the town a favor by taking the teenagers into his home. They would no longer be reliant upon Greenland's charity or considered a financial nuisance. Ona Staines said goodbye to her daughters, now indentured servants, who would serve out an 8-month contract. It was probably at this moment that her son William followed in his father's footsteps and left home to look for wages as a sailor. He was only 16 years old, but life in Greenland had become too difficult, and Ona Staines could do nothing to help. William left Greenland for new East Coast seaports and was never again recorded as a resident in New Hampshire. His mother's depression must have been suffocating. In April of 1817, the Staines daughters returned home, but Eliza, the eldest, didn't stay long. The Johnsons expected Eliza Staines to serve them for an additional 9 months, and this time she would not have the company of her sister for comfort. As Ona Staines worried about her daughter, still caught in the unpredictable web of servitude, things grew even bleaker. The fall brought the typical cold weather of New England, as well as the death of the Jack patriarch. 13 years had passed since the death of Phyllis Jack, and neighbors came to the family's aid when the family found themselves unable to pay for a funeral. When Eliza Staines returned in January of 1818, she came home to a house full of women trapped in poverty, with very little chance of escaping it. The women in the Jack household did odd jobs, domestic work, and anything that could bring in additional income. Both Nancy and Eliza Staines were known around the town for their artistic abilities, and as they grew into adulthood, they began to sell their sketches to wealthy Portsmouth families. The Jack sisters never married, and neither did the Staines girls, leaving the five women to muscle their way through the early years of antebellum America. Little changed in their material lives as their small house began to show signs of aging. The women of the house were simply happy to have a roof over their heads. Poverty's roots were deep. The 1830s tested Ona Staines in ways that were unimaginable. That her northern-born daughters would die before her was a cruel twist of fate, another unfair and unseemingly insurmountable blow. On February 16, 1832, Eliza Staines died at the age of 34 after a long and distressing illness. She was followed by her sister Nancy on September 11, 1833. Never released from the grasp of poverty, Eliza and Nancy Staines experienced lives that were filled with challenges, concerns about hunger, forced servitude, and the ever-present fear of slave catchers. Ona Staines did the best she could to raise her daughters, and now in her late 50s, she was once again alone. It was her faith in God that carried Ona Staines through the most difficult times in her life. In her later years, Staines reminisced about her sojourn to Christianity and literacy, two silos that she encountered once she fled north. Staines recounted that she never received the least mental or moral instruction of any kind while she remained in the Washington family. For many fugitives and former slaves, access to education and the ability to practice religion in their own ways were markers of freedom. By the 1840s, literacy rates among free African Americans were climbing, and Staines linked her newly found literacy to her religious practice, telling another interviewer that the ability to read the Bible and participate in religious events made her wise unto salvation. She questioned George Washington's religious practice, prompting her interviewer to write, "She never heard Washington pray, and does not believe that he was accustomed to." While there are many accounts of the first president attending church services, Staines questioned his devotion and did not leave Martha Washington out of her commentary. She stated, "Mrs. Washington used to read prayers, but I do not call that praying." It was Staines's own strong connection to the church that prompted her to question Martha Washington's religious integrity. Ona Staines probably attended Reverend Samuel Haven's South Church, the place where she married Jack Staines, but she was moved to join the Baptist denomination after hearing the sermons of Elias Smith, an itinerant preacher who traveled around New England during the 1790s, landing permanently in Portsmouth by 1802. Once she moved in with the Jack family, Staines probably attended the Baptist Church in Streatham, only a mile's walk from her home. Decades later, it was this connection that brought Reverend Thomas Archibald to interview the aging fugitive. Archibald published this first interview on May 22, 1845, in the Granite Freeman, an abolitionist newspaper. The article appeared on the 49th anniversary of her escape, almost to the day. With her children deceased, the elderly Ona Staines no longer hid from the spotlight. Now in her early 70s, the fear of being returned to the Park Custis heirs had finally been vanquished. Her Granite Freeman interview appeared a week before the paper's announcement of a new publication, a narrative written by a man named Frederick Douglass. It might not have been her intention to be grouped with other famous fugitives such as Frederick Douglass, but she was. 2 years later, on New Year's Day, Ona Staines's story appeared in the leading abolitionist newspaper of the era, The Liberator. Her name and life story were finally known to thousands of readers across the nation, permanently linking her to the crusade for black freedom in the years leading up to the Civil War. Interviewer Benjamin Chase, anti-slavery convention attendant and ardent abolitionist, was lucky to record his interview with Staines when he did. A little over a year later, in February of 1848, Dr. George Odell paid a call to the Jack household, where Ona Staines and Nancy Jack resided. Nancy's sister, Phyllis Jack, had died, so the two elderly women were left alone. Dr. Odell's house call was most likely to treat an ailing Ona Staines, now close to 74 years old. But whatever cures or treatment he may have prescribed were unsuccessful. On February 25th, 1848, 11 days after the doctor's visit, Ona Maria Staines was carried away, not by slave catchers, but by her God. Epilogue. Ona's sister, Philadelphia Costin. When Ona Staines was asked to reflect upon her escape, her interviewer put forth a question that could be asked of any successful fugitive who lived a life in the shadows. The interviewer wrote, "When asked if she is not sorry she left Washington, as she has labored so much harder since than before, her reply is, 'No, I am free, and I have, I trust, been made a child of God by the means.'" Although she never regretted her escape, she could not forget her family members who still lived at Mount Vernon. Leaving them behind was the greatest of sacrifices. The slave woman surely wrestled with her soul, thinking about the consequences of her actions and how they might place her family in harm's way. How could her family ever forgive her for abandoning them? What would become of them? Instead of visualizing their anger and feelings of betrayal, she must have hoped for her family's blessing, imagining them secretly cheering for her as she risked everything to find freedom. Ona Staines would have no idea that the price of her freedom carried such a steep penalty for her loved ones, most specifically for her younger sister, Philadelphia. Staines's escape from a life under the scrutiny of Eliza Custis' law had unintended consequences, and Philadelphia ended up in the very position that Staines had refused to accept. Passed down to the volatile granddaughter of the Washingtons, Philadelphia found herself living the life that was intended for her older sister. The fugitive's younger sister did what most enslaved people were trained to do. She survived the best she could. Philadelphia probably never believed that one day she too would be free. When the Washingtons returned to Mount Vernon in the early summer of 1796 without Ona Staines, there was no way to prevent the rumors and gossip that spread like contagion through the slave quarters and the mansion house. Her disappearance served as a reminder to all who labored at Mount Vernon that when given the right opportunity, freedom could be taken. Her departure must have earned her special acknowledgement, perhaps a hero's recognition, among the Washington slaves. But no matter how proud or elated, the slaves at Mount Vernon had to suppress any expression of joy. Driven into the unspoken alcoves of their minds, the fugitive took her place among the fabled stories of other slaves who had risked everything for freedom. The enslaved Harry, Tom, and Will Shagg were among the few bondmen at Mount Vernon who had gambled on escape. Sometimes they found their freedom, but most often they met with capture and the auction block. Ona's name was now firmly rooted in the legend of freedom makers. Not everyone shared the hidden enthusiasm regarding the fugitive's escape. Martha Washington was deeply disturbed by the abandonment of her slave, for not only did her bondwoman break the law by running away, She also destroyed the First Lady's plans of assistance for her newly married and now pregnant granddaughter. Martha Washington was forced to make new arrangements regarding Eliza Custis Law, and she turned to a young Philadelphia. Only 16 years old, Philadelphia was saddled with the responsibility of serving the new Mrs. Law. Perhaps Philadelphia had proven herself to be trustworthy and reliable, and was therefore the natural replacement for her older sister. Or maybe, in a fit of anger, Mrs. Washington purposely selected Philadelphia to serve the new Mrs. Law, a duty that would require her to leave Mount Vernon and head for a new home in the federal city. If vindictiveness was her motive, Martha Washington was successful. Philadelphia followed in her older sister's footsteps, leaving behind the world she knew at Mount Vernon. Both Ona Staines and Philadelphia traveled through similar rites of passage. Torn from their homes, the sisters were sent to live and serve in new cities. On January 19, 1797, Mrs. Law and her new husband Thomas welcomed the arrival of a baby girl, Elizabeth Park Custis Law. Much like their fast and furious courtship and marriage, the union brought sudden and sweeping change to Mount Vernon. Upon her marriage, Eliza Law received a portion of her inheritance from her late grandfather, Daniel Park Custis, an inheritance that included a significant number of slaves. Eliza's marriage and the birth of a baby expedited Philadelphia's departure from Mount Vernon. Existing records do not mention her exact date of departure, but according to Washington's records, Philadelphia was still spinning at Mount Vernon as late as April of 1797. Sometime after that, Philadelphia would go to live with the Laws in Georgetown. When the Congress decided upon the Potomac River location for the nation's new capital, there were two established towns in the area, Alexandria and Georgetown. Located at the southern tip of the District of Columbia, Alexandria was considered to be a handsome Virginia town with attractive homes and a growing population, while Georgetown was separated from the federal city by Rock Creek and was considered a bit more remote. By 1800, Georgetown counted close to 2,000 black residents, the vast majority of whom were enslaved. Both Philadelphia and Ona Staines witnessed the slow growth of black freedom. For Ona Staines, the experience was more dramatic, as slavery was near extinction in her northern city by the time of her escape. When Philadelphia arrived in Georgetown, she must have taken quick notice of the small but growing number of free black residents. Close to 300 free blacks lived in Georgetown, and more than 350 lived in Alexandria. Philadelphia would watch the number of free blacks in the District of Columbia grow steadily, but so too did slavery. Enslavement and liberty wrestled with each other in the first two decades of the 19th century, with black bondage losing its might by the 1830s. Just as Ona Staines found marriage and companionship with a husband, so too did Philadelphia. Both women selected free men as spouses, a decision that would help each of them hold on to the elusive grasp of freedom. Although the date is uncertain, Philadelphia eventually married a man named William Costin, who many believe was the son of Anne Dandridge, Martha Washington's legendary interracial half-sister. Dandridge was believed by some to be the offspring of Martha Washington's father and an enslaved woman. Several oral histories and accounts state that Dandridge eventually gave birth to a son named William, whose father was Jackie Custis, the son of Martha Washington. If these accounts and recent genealogy are accurate, William Costin was the nephew and the grandson of the First Lady. Whatever Costin's lineage may have been, he was considered a free man, never appearing on the slave inventories at Mount Vernon. Costin eventually moved from Virginia to the new federal city, harnessing the limited power he possessed as a free black man. Over time, Costin would use his money and his relationships to secure the freedom of his family members and his friends. As slavery's laws grew more restrictive in Virginia and Maryland, free blacks took flight from these states, bolting for the capital city. Slave resistance was on the mind of many, as white residents read about bloody slave rebellion in Haiti. Virginians shuddered as they learned of a failed insurrection by an enslaved blacksmith named Gabriel. The bondman from the Prosser estate planned to attack Capitol Square in Richmond, take the governor hostage, and negotiate for black freedom. Liberty became more difficult to secure and harder to maintain in Virginia, a likely reason for William Costin's migration to the federal city. Or perhaps it was Philadelphia's presence in Georgetown that prompted a young Costin to follow his heart and relocate. The promise of a life in a new city must have been a welcomed option as the home he knew at Mount Vernon came undone. Martha Washington died on May 22, 1802, and while her family, friends, and the public mourned her death, the dour slaves at Mount Vernon were likely consumed with fear. The day of reckoning had come. Martha Washington's will mandated that all of her slaves were to be divided among her grandchildren, a plan that would break slave families apart. The Custis grandchildren were all adults at the time of their grandmother's passing, and all except George Washington Parke Custis, Washy, were married. The estate that George and Martha Washington had safeguarded for nearly half a century was to be transferred, and the division of property, including enslaved men and women, would increase the wealth of the Custis grandchildren. Eliza Custis Law was bequeathed 43 slaves, including Philadelphia, who was assigned a value of £80. Eliza Law's sisters also inherited a significant number of slaves. Martha Custis Peter received 48 enslaved people, and Nellie Custis Lewis was bequeathed 33 human souls. George Washington Parke Custis, the only male grandchild, was allotted 36 slaves, one of whom was Elish, Martha Washington's sole slave who was not a part of the Custis estate. A number of slaves who were willed to George Washington Parke Custis came as family units. A slave woman named Caroline and her four daughters, Rachel, Jemima, Leanth, and Polly, managed to avoid separation and began their new assignment together. Philadelphia's sister-in-law, Charlotte, once married to the late Austin, managed to keep her sons Billy and Tim and her daughters Elvie and Eliza by her side. Betty Davis was also among the fortunate, as she kept her nuclear family together. In 1797, Davis had given birth to a third daughter named Lucinda, who along with her mother and two sisters waited for word about their futures. With her sister Philadelphia, assigned to Eliza Law, and another sister, Ona Staines, still on the run, Davis clung desperately to her daughters. Betty Davis, Nancy, Oney, and Lucinda were all transferred to the estate of George Washington Parke Custis, eventually residing at his home in Arlington. Davis was listed with a value of £60, Nancy £50, Oney £35, and Lucinda was worth £20. The death of the matriarch ended almost 50 years of tradition at Mount Vernon. Feelings of deep uncertainty touched all who were connected to the estate of the Washingtons. However, for Eliza Law, there were additional matters that troubled her. Aside from losing her grandmother, Mrs. Law observed the deterioration of her marriage, a relationship that had steadily grown more troubled. The whirlwind romance that developed into a marriage had come undone over the course of 8 years. Family members and friends commented upon the demise of the Law marriage, suggesting that both parties involved created a host of marital problems. During Martha Washington's last years, the couple stifled their unhappiness in order to spare the family's matriarch from pain or concern. But following Martha Washington's death, Thomas Law traveled to Europe, and shortly after his return, the couple made the decision to separate. On August 9, 1804, Thomas and Eliza agreed upon a legal separation, with Thomas Law offering real estate and a $1,500 annuity to his estranged wife. Eliza Law left the District of Columbia for Maryland, where she spent an extended period of time with her aunt and uncle. Rosalie Steer Calvert, Law's aunt, placed the blame of the failed marriage on both Thomas and Eliza, writing, "It is a sad thing to see two people with a child separate without good reason. You know what an odd man Thomas Law has always been. She had a disposition completely opposite to his, and she wasn't sensible enough to put up with his peculiarities. The result is that they are both at fault, which is usually the case." Just as Eliza and Thomas Law's marriage changed the lives of both Ona Staines and Philadelphia, so too did their eventual divorce. The Laws lived estranged from one another for close to 6 years, with Law eventually filing a bill of divorce in 1810. Thomas Law was granted custody of their young daughter Eliza, who would eventually attend boarding school in Philadelphia. But what remains unclear was the fate of all the bound laborers who served the Law family. As Eliza Law reclaimed her Custis surname, she began a nomadic life. Custis purchased a small home in Alexandria that she named Mount Washington and lived there from 1805 to 1809. At some point during the Law's legal separation, Eliza Custis gave her estranged husband permission to emancipate some of her slaves. On June 13, 1807, Thomas Law gave Philadelphia her freedom, signing her manumission papers in consideration of $1. He may have emancipated her because the maintenance and taxes on slave labor exacerbated his already cash-strapped affairs. And like Washington, Law had a change of heart about the probity of slavery. Certainly, Law was no strident abolitionist, and while married to Eliza Custis, he lived with and profited from slave labor. But bound labor must not have settled well with Thomas Law, and his belief in gradual emancipation and the eventual relocation of black people emerged after the end of his marriage. We do know that by the time of her emancipation, Philadelphia was close to 28 years old and was married to William Costin. The couple did not wait for freedom to begin their family, a risky decision given the inheritable slave status that could have locked their children into bound labor. Thomas Law not only emancipated Philadelphia Costin, but he also set free her two children, 2-year-old Louisa and 4-month-old Anne. That same year, Thomas Law released additional members of the Costin family, most of whom were women and children. Among those emancipated was William Costin's mother, Anne Dandridge, who had married and taken the surname Holmes. The Costins took advantage of their free status and became well-known members of the free black community in Washington, D.C. They expanded their family, purchased property, and assisted men and women who looked desperately for an exit from human bondage. Although emancipated, Philadelphia Costin understood just how tenuous her free status was. Slavery would live on in the District of Columbia for more than another 50 years, and as long as it existed, Philadelphia Costin could never rest without concern. Kidnappers surveyed the streets of the federal city, instilling fear and vulnerability into the hearts of men and women who possessed freedom papers, papers that were meaningless to unscrupulous slave catchers. The former slave needed to stay vigilant and not let her family's newly found opportunity take down her guard. Philadelphia's emancipation was not surprising, and was most likely due to the valued relationship between her husband and Martha Washington's grandchildren. William Costin became one of the pillars of early black society in Washington, amassing property and moderate wealth over the course of his lifetime, landing a job as a porter at the Bank of Washington, a title that he kept for more than 25 years. Costin's free status and financial security allowed him to agitate for the rights of free blacks and to help those who were still enslaved. Eliza Custis Law trusted William Costin, calling on his carriage-driving services and, on occasion, even asking for financial help. Costin obliged whenever he could, which in turn helped to secure his own family's freedom. Costin must have been a charismatic man, but when natural charm failed him, he could be a force to be reckoned with. When black codes grew tighter in Washington, Costin sued the city. Black codes required that every free black person appear before the mayor with documents signed by 3 different white citizens, attesting to good character. But white references were not enough for the mayor, so an imposed $20 peace bond was mandated, requiring free blacks to offer advance payment as a commitment to good behavior. Although the judge believed that Costin should be exempted from the new requirement, the laws remained intact. The personal exemption for Costin was in no way a victory for all free blacks. When Costin couldn't fight the law and win, he simply used it to his favor. Committed to helping friends and family find their way to freedom, Costin had to play the game. He became a slave owner. Throughout the 1820s, William Costin purchased and emancipated a number of enslaved men and women, many of whom had a direct connection to Mount Vernon. 28-year-old Leanth Brannan, daughter of Caroline, was one of the beneficiaries of Costin's moral compass. She, too, had been a slave at Mount Vernon, but by 1820, Costin purchased her from George Washington Park Custis, and then offered the woman a chance to buy her own freedom for $5. Perhaps Custis's participation in the colonization movement made him more amenable to emancipating Brannan. More likely, it was the mutually beneficial relationship between Custis and Costin that allowed for deals to be struck. Costin's work with the Bank of Washington, an entrepreneurial spirit, placed him in a favorable light with the Custis heirs. On occasion, the grandchildren wrote to Costin asking him for help with transportation from his hack business. But more important than a carriage ride was Costin's position at the bank, one that allowed for the Washington grandchildren to borrow money when necessary. The agreeable relationship between William Costin, often referred to as Billy, and the Custis heirs placed him in the perfect position to become an agent of change. He leveraged this relationship in order to purchase his family and friends. As William Costin slowly led his family and friends out of slavery's grasp, Ona Staines remained tucked away in Greenland's seclusion. Perhaps she had known that her younger sister Philadelphia lived a good life as a free woman. It would have offered her peace of mind and a temporary salve to the difficult life she lived as a fugitive. If she knew that some of her old friends had managed to make it out of slavery, it might have eased her suffering that came with the loss of a husband and desperate poverty. Certainly, Ona Staines would have rejoiced at the news that her namesake and niece, Ona Fortune, was one of the lucky family members purchased and emancipated by William Costin. Had she known all of this information, it might have erased the only remorse, the only regret she carried with her to the grave. Ona Staines had walked away from her family at Mount Vernon, seizing an opportune moment, and she never looked back. To know that her family would eventually prosper as free people would have confirmed that her choice to escape had been a good one. Her life had been difficult, but for 52 years, Ona Staines never lost faith in herself. Every day that the fugitive opened her eyes, she knew one thing to be true. She would rather suffer death than return to slavery.
Never caught, the Washingtons' relentless pursuit of their runaway slave, Ona Judge, was written by Erica Armstrong Dunbar and read by Robin Miles. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Never Caught is available in print from Atria.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.